Welcome to the Court of Colonel Peels. You know, it's nice to see so many people here because usually no one wants to visit us. It's amazing. But we're very pleased to have you here. And I want to introduce all of the dignitaries here, but I think unfortunately it would take us all day. But I want to start out by thanking Senator Ellis not only for helping me put all of this together, but for the meet and greet this morning. And we have Gary Sheck, who's flown in from New York to give a presentation this morning and in the afternoon. Of course, we have the district attorney, whose name is familiar to all of you, Craig Watkins. And I'm going to let the panel members introduce themselves to you in a minute. I also want to take the time to thank my colleagues, Judge Keller and Judge Kiesler are here, and a couple of the other judges are going to come in a little later. I think Judge Womack's on his way in, and Judge Myers as well. So I wanted to thank them. And I wanted to thank them for their support because several of them have stepped up to the plate and have come in and offered their services for the unit. Judge Keller is our presiding judge, and she is also the chair of the Indigent Defense Task Force, and she's also the chair of the Mental Health Task Force. And in those roles, she's going to coordinate efforts with the unit so that we can educate everyone in the system as to better defense services and some new and interesting things the Mental Health Task Force is doing with regard to mentally ill people that need assistance in the court system. So we will be educating people working with those two task forces. Judge Kiesler is our resident professor that travels. Judge Kiesler teaches all over the world, even went to Micronesia a few years ago to teach. And he's sought after with the National College of the Judiciary out in Reno, and he teaches all over the country. And he has agreed to head up what I hope will be a very successful education unit where we can call upon defense attorneys, prosecutors, forensics people, law enforcement, and of course the judiciary to educate. The first and foremost goal of this unit is to educate. And we want everyone in the state of Texas that's involved in the criminal justice system to at least be on the same page. It would be nice if we could all hold hands and agree to all the changes that need to be made, but we know that's impossible. But we at least have to be on the same page as to what is out there and keep up with modern trends and be open to new ideas and be able to at least exchange ideas and have open dialogue so we can improve the system. A little queer thing I did when people asked me when I ran, why I was running, because I was a prosecutor in Bexar County in the appellate section for 16 years before I ran for office. And people asked me why I ran, and I said, well, I've been doing this work for a while, I think I can do the work, but basically, if you don't move to improve yourself, then you get stale and something wrong. The same goes for every single system, and now we're talking about the criminal justice system. Be unrealistic for us to say that any system doesn't need improvement, and we know the criminal justice system needs reform. So that's what this is about. I have several personal goals. I'm sure my committee members will have other goals, and we're going to work fast and furiously. Like I said, we're going to accomplish a lot of these things for education instead of, you know, having the legislature necessarily have to dictate or mandate to people because people don't like that very much. And education isn't very costly. So the court is also in a position because we oversee the large Fund 540 education grant, which educates defense attorneys, prosecutors, and judges throughout the state. And because of our position as the Supreme Court for criminal cases, we're in a great position to see what is necessary in terms of education. We receive between 6,000 and 8,000 post-conviction writs a year. And I'm not talking about death writs, just regular writs. And from those writs, we see, you know, repetition in some of the issues, like ineffective assistance. Every lawyer in the state is ineffective according to the writs. But there are things like prosecutorial misconduct, innocence, the list goes on and on. And so there are some areas where we can make some suggestions to our committees to do new or better education for their constituents. Most of the grantees are very good at responding rapidly to our suggestions for the need for education. So I'll go over my dreams and goals later, But at this time, I would like the panel members to just give a brief introduction of themselves so everybody knows who you are. Jim, we'll start with you.
Good, Sherry. Thanks. And first, I want to thank you for appointing me to this. It's just an honor to serve with you. I serve as the director of the State Task Force on Indigent Defense. We are a permanent standing committee of the Texas Judicial Council, which is basically a policy arm of the Texas courts.
Good morning. Thank you, Judge, for appointing me as well. My name is Seth Harlan. I'm a district judge from San Antonio. I've been on the bench since 88. Currently serve on the Judicial Conduct Commission as well, and primarily hear criminal cases. Was in the DA's office with Barbara as well.
I'm Hannah Esparza, a judge. Thank you for the appointment. I've been the DA for 16 years in El Paso. My jurisdiction covers El Paso, Husband, and Culberson counties. They're the further west counties in the state. And I have, for the years I've been licensed as a lawyer, practiced criminal law as a prosecutor, and a few years as a public defender.
And I'm Jim McReynolds. I serve in the Texas House. I've served 12 years. I'm currently serving on the Corrections Committee and the Appropriations Committee. I'm excited about what we're doing today.
I'm Ron Hillis from Houston. I've been in the State Senate 18 years. Also, chair on the board of the Innocence Project out of New York, and have been involved in a number of criminal justice reforms throughout my career in the Senate.
My name is Craig Watkins. I'm the district attorney from Dallas County. I've been in office a little over a year and a half. And we started the mission some months ago. And as a result of that, we've seen some cases that need to be looked at.
You know
why. Okay. I'm Gary Yudish, and I'm a criminal defense lawyer from Dallas.
Pat Johnson, I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety and Crime Laboratories. I've served in that role for 2 years, but I've been in the crime lab business for 30-plus. Glad to serve you.
James is also a general counsel and executive director for the Texas Police Chiefs Association. And I, too, want to thank you, Judge, for the opportunity to meet with you.
Well, thank you. Some of our members couldn't be here today. Jill Allison works at the UT Innocence Clinic, and he is out of the country. He does have a representative here. Mr. Shepherd is in the back to represent UT. And Marianne Wiley is deputy general counsel with the governor's office. I do want you to know I had a 20-minute one-on-one conversation with the governor about the creation of this unit, and he does support our efforts. And also missing is Jerry Madden, a House representative, and he couldn't be here today, but sends his regards. So those are our members. Now, without further ado, Senator, do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Briefly, Judge, first I want to thank you and presiding Judge Keller for the leadership that you have shown on this issue, and your other colleagues, some of whom are here and some are going to join us later. But more than anything, I want to thank you for stepping up to the plate, so to speak. I thought the symbolism of having this meeting, this dialogue in this chamber was important, which is why I encouraged you to have it here, as was the case when we had our dialogue with Barry Sheck and others helping organize it on the Senate floor a month or so ago. I think these issues of criminal justice reforms are very difficult discussions to have in a public environment. But it's important because in Texas, we do incarcerate a larger percentage of our citizens than any other state in the country. Probably a larger percentage than most countries in the free world and the not-so-free world. We also execute more people in Texas than most places on the planet. So I think that makes it incumbent upon us to do as much as we can to get it right. I think that the American criminal justice system is not perfect, but it's about the best one I know of. But it doesn't mean that we cannot make it better. And that's why I think this dialogue is important. I just want to briefly run through something that I mentioned when we met on the Senate floor, and that would be the exoneration facts, the things that we know are contributing factors in DNA exonerations in Texas. And I think the DNA exonerations are important because even the most unreasonable person would find it difficult to argue with the fact that these were instances when a wrong person was incarcerated and a real person who did it probably felt pretty empowered because they got away with it and knew the wrong person was in jail. Texas, of course, leads the nation now with 33 exonerations, with the recent one as of yesterday out of Dallas County. That puts our number, I guess Dallas puts our number 34, Craig, with the exoneration from yesterday. I think it comes to a total of 427 years in which the wrong man, so far in Texas, has been all men were in prison. Eyewitness misidentification was present in 27 cases. That's 82% of them. So maybe brings to the table the discussion about, is there anything we can learn from these 82% of those cases about reforming ID, whether it's voluntary through education or through legislation or courtroom. False forensic testimony was present in 6 cases, 18% of them. Reliance on unreliable or limited forensic methodologies, junk science, was present in 8 cases, 24%. Informant or accomplice testimony from witnesses with an incentive to lie was found in 5 cases, 15%. False confessions or guilty pleas were involved in 3 cases, 9%. Suppression of exculpatory evidence or other misconduct was found in 4 cases, 12%. 21 of the 33, I guess if I went to 34, the one yesterday would be 22 were African American, 1 was Asian, 7 was Anglo, 6 were Latino, or whatever that says about folks. Texas, I think, still ranks pretty low, Jim Becky, in terms of the percentage of amount of money, doctor, that the state puts in to indigent vets. Prior to 2001, the state of Texas didn't put anything into it. And when we passed the bill that created the entity that you now are executive director of, Jim, we funded it with a court fee. And not necessarily the best way to do it, because you put a burden on people who have been accused, rightfully or wrongfully. But look, hey, system's not perfect. It was the best we could do. We got to do it. We got it done. I'm hoping what comes out of this is a dialogue that will lead to some momentum, Presiding Judge and Judge Herbert, to the extent the legislature needs to look at making some changes. We give them some impetus to get it done. It's not enough in a state that incarcerates so many of its citizens, executes so many people, to just leave this to happenstance. If it means, doctor, to get some of these bills passed, the governor ought to give them the emergency tag. It is really a priority, so we can get them passed sooner. We ought to do that. I'm sure somebody will look back at us 20, 15, 100 years from now and ask, were we nuts? I mean, how could we have a system where, by and large, your income, to some extent, determine whether or not you're innocent? I mean, they will look back at us in the history books and wonder, what were we doing? And that's what I'm hoping will come out of this. For these 34 individuals that were wrongfully convicted, we ought to look at what responsibility the state has to help put their lives back in order, or as close to being in order as possible. Should we give them tuition and fees to go to a community college? Or college, Texas grant, whatever it is. Should we give them money while they're waiting to get their pardon of innocence? Which some, it might take a year. Person who carried you all let out yesterday. You have to go through a process. Well, when they get out, they don't even get what you get when you get on parole. You get out on parole, you get the bus ticket, and you get somebody helping you find a job. But these folks in limbo. I know it's chair of the Board of Innocence Project. After these lawyers, this is a not-for-profit, no government money, no money from Texas. All money coming from people on the East Coast and West Coast primarily that care about our criminal justice system. Then after Barry and his young lawyers get these folks out, law students at Cardozo Law School do a lot of work on it, get these folks out. They're just in limbo. It's like the system leaves them in limbo hoping they'll do something wrong because they're desperate. And they have to go back and stay with family members that they haven't had a relationship with, in some cases, for many years. And they really are liberal. Shit, state, do something while you're waiting. They need mental health counseling. You'll find, if you look at most of the exonerees in the country, one of the role models, one, is a guy that Governor Bush gave a pardon of innocence named Anthony Robinson. And he was the person that was a catalyst for Texas moving the compensation for the wrongfully convicted from 25,000 period to 25,000 a year in 2001. It's now, of course, 50 years. If you're on death row, you're on persons 100, you with no cap. But Anthony Robinson got out because of overcrowding in prison under Ann Richards' watch as governor. And I guess you had to go to these classes and say, I did it, I know I did it. But he took a job as a day laborer for about 2 years to come up with enough money for somebody to take his case. Then, good lawyer, said, we got to pay the owner again. Everybody says they have. Took him another year. I think day laborers collect cans or whatever. I was so impressed with this guy's testimony, I decided to take him on this project and helped him get into law school, raised the money for him to go to law school. And when he finished law school, he went to get a master's in international law from Renmin University in China. He's in China now. He'd be a role model. There's a woman that did a documentary for PBS, can't remember her name now, Barry, who told me out of all the exonerees that she surveyed over about a two-year period, he was the strongest and most impressive one in life. But even Anthony, with his law degree, his JD, and his master's in international law, last time I saw him, he stopped by my house a couple months ago. He's in Houston. He still keeps a log every day of everywhere he went. In the event he ever gets in trouble again, he wants to, at the end of every day, he sits down and goes back and does a log of everywhere he went. And I said, Anthony, at some point you got to, get over it. You got to move on. And he says, son of a, I appreciate all you've done for me, but you never really get over it. So I think we ought to look at what we ought to do to help these people put their lives back in our East 34 Texas. But more than anything, I'm hoping what comes out of this dialogue is us putting some policies, whether they're legislative, administrative, best practices, whatever works, to make sure that this never, ever happens again. And if it does, at least we would know we did our best to try and prevent it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to just briefly honor to recognize Judge Myers, who just joined us. Judge Myers.
Well, we have to do it briefly, can we do it?
Judge Myers has volunteered to be our legislative
liaison. No, I have not. I have been in Shanghai. Doing it because that's the only way I'm here. She'll vote for my opinion. So now I'm glad to appreciate the recognition.
I also wanted to introduce our general counsel, Sion, and she's the queen of writs. Now she's general counsel, but Sion has been instrumental in helping us begin the education process for judges on writs, and I'll talk about what my plans are for that project a little more in depth. But thank you, Sion. At this time, I'd like to have Mr. Watkins address us and tell us about his successes in Dallas.
Good morning, first of all. And, we started this, looking at this whole issue about the second week I was elected, because we had an exoneration the second week that I took office. And I met with the exoneree and Barry Sheck and talked about these issues. And so the Conviction Integrity Unit was created, and Mike Ware here, he works with the DA, he's head of our Conviction Integrity Unit. And specifically, we created it to really look at, the 400 cases that have been denied in Dallas County under the new law which allowed post-conviction DNA testing. And as a result of that, since we've been in office, over the last, I think the unit's been in place for about a year now.
Just a little over a year.
Unfortunately, we have come up with about eight exonerations in a little over a year. And I think that's indicative of where we need to look at how we can improve the system. Now, you guys have probably seen all of the media accounts of me and how they pitting me against Henry Wade. It's Watkins versus Wade or something like that. That was never our intention. It was never our intention to criticize Henry Wade or criticize anyone that's been part of the criminal justice system for a long time. It was always our intention for us to look at and be honest about the failures of the system and move forward. Unfortunately, a lot of folks in the media like to sell their stories, so they may get this competition of the past versus the future, which we shouldn't look at it from that standpoint. And what's really exciting is that we're meeting here the individuals that have participated in criminal law for a long time who may have been a part of some of these things that went on are willing to listen and willing to take a look at it and willing to fix it. And as we go forward, I just hope that we can get past the criticism. We can criticize one another all day. We've made this into a political issue now, and it shouldn't be. Every 4 years I get to run for DA and I get to be a politician, but right now, it's about doing the right thing and fixing the system. And I think Texas can be the state that implements these changes because of the numbers that we just got from Senator Ellis. We should be on the forefront of making sure that we get it right. I think there's another issue that we need to deal with. And Senator Madden, he's not here, but he talks about it all the time. The fact that we are not getting a return on our investment for the individuals that we do punish and that we do incarcerate. At some point, we're going to have to think about it from an economical standpoint and figure out how can we get a return on our investment when we spend so much money imprisoning individuals. And those individuals that were in prison, more times than not, end up recidivating. And so, to me, I think that we're just spinning our wheels, and the political side of it is we can get on TV and say we're being tough on crime, but in fact, we're not. We're actually contributing to the problem when we don't address the issues as to why we're incarcerating someone. Because that individual inevitably is going to get out. He's going to come back to our communities and our neighborhoods and live on our streets. And if he is still a criminal, then he will continue to be a criminal. And so as a district attorney of the county that I live in, my responsibility is to protect the citizens that I represent. And by just incarcerating someone, it's not doing that. It's actually making it worse. And so there are a lot of issues that we need to look at. Senator Ellis has gone over those. He's gone over the numbers. But this is an opportunity for us to move forward and get it right.
Thank you.
Judge, the Fair Defense Act passed in 2002, and it's an organization. I have 13 board members who I answer to, and ultimately the board are the ones who set the policy. And as a state employee, ultimately our job as state employees is to carry out that policy that the board set. And I'd like to compliment our chair, the Honorable Sharon Keller. I'm confident there's probably some people in this room that would have thought, well, this task force, I'm not really sure what it's going to do or what it's going to accomplish. But in 6 years, there's been an awful lot that has been accomplished. We still have a long, long ways to go. And it was an organization that I wasn't really that interested in heading up initially. I had a great job, one where I was liked and respected. And hopefully that hasn't changed, but it was not near as volatile. One of the things that, and I wanted to take a couple of minutes to talk about some of our accomplishments, and then really kind of how I'm hoping that this organization, we're able to work together collaboratively to bring about some progress and incrementally. But in 2002, Texas per capita we were 48th in the nation. There was a lot of issues that were chronicled where there was abuses of the system. Senator Ellis and
and the House passed the Fair Defense Law. And when they created us, what they did, for the first time in Texas history, provided some state money. Texas at that time was one of four states that provided no state funding for indigent defense services. And in 2002, it was $9 million. Part of that, whenever the state does provide money, there's going to be some requirements and strains. And one of the things that was required was local jurisdictions to come up with a plan on how they were going to provide indigent defense services. All 254 of our counties went ahead and prepared a local plan guided by the principles of the Fair Defense Act. And we've got all those posted on the website. The other part that I think was really, really critical was that local governments, through the auditor or treasurer, was required to report how much money they're expending. And so this, for the first time, we're able to really see statewide how much money it's costing to provide court-appointed counsel to people that are too poor to hire this. How much is being spent on experts and investigators, things of that nature. And be able to kind of compare across jurisdictions. Again, all 254 counties report that annually. So we're able to report to the legislature and say, okay, in 2001, before the Fair Defense Act, $91 million was spent on indigent defense services in the state of Texas. Last year, it was $160 million. No state, since the inception of the Fair Defense Act, has put more money and resources into indigent defense. Now, that being said, I think we still have a gap to close. We've gone per capita 48th to 43rd. We have almost 1 million eligible new offenses that are filed each year, be misdemeanor and above. Our average cost for felonies, it's $400, $375 for a misdemeanor case. There's a lot of very capable, competent criminal defense lawyers, and I'm not sure the defense lawyers in here would even take a misdemeanor case, a Class C misdemeanor, for $400 or $300. But overall, there has been some significant awareness of this issue, and I'm certain that there's still abuses out there, but overall, a lot of jurisdictions have stepped up to the plate and said, we're going to provide better counsel. A lot of jurisdictions have also looked at setting up a public defender system. It's a policy that our board has supported. And one of the things that our board does is it provides incentives rather than penalties. And also, too, the board is very deferential to local control because the state, as Senator Ellis was alluding to, in 2001, they provided zero, no money. Now we're at about 12 to 13% of the overall budget. So my board did not want to micromanage to the local jurisdiction and say, okay, Dallas or Houston, this is the way you've got to do it. What they've done is they provided us the tools, the staff, and have contracted and with the Texas A&M Public Policy Research Institute and other organizations to do studies on what's working, what's not working, so that local stakeholders can make an informed decision. And in 2001, we had 7 public defender offices in the state of Texas. Now we have 15 public defender offices. So we've doubled the number of public defender offices. And one of the things when we've set up these offices, we've been able to exercise a little more control over the quality of the services. The board doesn't just say, okay, county, here's money for a public defender office. They say that if you're going to set one up, you've got to have, you know, caseload standards. There's got to be some type of performance review. We want to see what we're getting for this. You need to report back to us how this has improved your system. The last item I'd like to address briefly, and we've got some of the heads of these organizations, Jeff Blackburn, who heads up the Innocence Project of Texas, and Tiffany and David with UT, and Cassandra with U of H. In 2005, the Texas legislature directed us to provide some state money for the Innocence Projects of the state. I'm not sure if TSU is here. Is there Sean McDonald? And our board provides the four public law schools up to $100,000 a year for its innocence work. It's been pleasurable to work with these groups. We had a number of meetings on when these groups were originally formed on how can we go ahead and run this effectively. And so we had a number of meetings, and then the governor's office stepped up to the plate and said, we didn't want these monies to go towards, you know, getting computers. We wanted it to go for direct client services. We wanted it for investigation. They said, what can we do? And so the governor's office provided our organization, the Office of Court Administration, a grant to set up an online reporting system so that anybody can kind of see how many cases and the workload that these organizations are doing. And also it was a information sharing tool for the schools, because one of the things, it makes sense sometimes for two separate schools to be working on the same case, but it also made sense for the two schools to know that each was working on that for a collaborative effort. So I think there's been some really good progress that's been made in that area, and pleased to be part of that.
Thank you. I wanted to acknowledge Judge Womack has joined us as well, and all your colleagues. Mr. Sheck, would you please grace us with your presentation?
It's really a great pleasure and privilege for me to be here. I'm kind of shocked. I've been litigating here in Texas, I guess, since 2000. I'm looking around the room, and I've met most of you one time or another. And so I can't thank Judge Hervey enough, and Judge Keller, and all the other judges here from the Court of Criminal Appeals, and, of course, Senator Ellis for putting this together, and Marianne Wiley, because this is the kind of collaborative process that in other jurisdictions has worked. So I think we've provided a handout here of Criminal Justice Reform Commissions, because I've been asked to sort of describe how that's been working in other jurisdictions. And I suddenly realized as I was listening to the presentations here that I probably should have started with an international perspective. Because last year I went to the 10th anniversary of what's known as the Criminal Case Review Commission in the United Kingdom. And this is a very interesting organization. The Criminal Case Review Commission was formed after there were these wrongful convictions in IRA terrorism cases, the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, and you might remember those movies, In the Name of the Father, right, with Emma Thompson. But after that, there were just a few wrongful convictions in the United Kingdom, and they decided to set up a whole government institution dedicated to this. And I was around when working with them when they first started it 10 years ago. And it's very interesting because they put millions of dollars into this institution, and so it is a government entity. They have former judges, police chiefs. They have free access to the Forensic Science Service Laboratory, and people will come before the commission, and they will make a case that they were wrongfully convicted. Now, it's a little weird because they don't have the same post-conviction system that we have here in the United States, and the Criminal Case Review Commission also takes on applications that they were excessive sentences. But it is quite a remarkable institution. At the 10-year anniversary, everybody on all sides of the criminal justice system was very pleased on how it had progressed. And they actually had a group that followed up on anybody that was exonerated and provided them social services and compensation. And they had really extensive investigation. There was role for a defense counsel. So that is a very interesting model. And perhaps the most interesting part of it, for our purposes, is that it actually provides a way to do fact-finding in cases of potential actual innocence. And what the CCRC does is that they'll take a hearing, they'll investigate the matter, and then if they think there actually was a potential miscarriage of justice, they will refer it back to the appellate courts, calling the conviction, as the British would, unsafe. Okay. The other model that is of great interest is the public inquiry model in Canada. There have been quite a number of wrongful convictions in Canada, and what they do, interestingly, is they will convene what they call a public inquiry, where the state will pay for a special master, essentially, and then there'll be lawyers for the person who was exonerated and some of the others within the system, and they will do a big report on what went wrong and make recommendations for how these kinds of things can be prevented in the future. It's very expensive, I must say, but they've come up with a lot of recommendations which are not dissimilar to the ones that we've had in other commissions in the United States. But that is another model that those two I didn't include in here. I should, because they're very robust, and there's a huge commitment by the state, both the prosecutors, the court system, and the legislatures to making those work. In the United States, there have been a number of these commissions that have been formed. Probably the latest one that's most interesting and you can read about online because it's perfectly transparent is the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice. This was set up in a fashion very similar to your commission here because it had representatives from all parts of the criminal justice system, police, prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, and the chair of it is John Vandekamp, and John had a very interesting career. He was a federal defender, started as a federal defender. Then he became a district attorney in Los Angeles for many years, and I guess for his trouble, he's been sued, and there's a big case on absolute immunity called Goldstein versus Vandekamp that's in front of the United States Supreme Court to be argued in November. Very ironic that he, of all people, would be sued years later because he's a fantastic guy. Then John, after many years in the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, he was also the Attorney General of the State of California. So he had a vast experience. They set up their commission at Santa Clara Law School. The executive director is Professor Jerry Oman, who was one of the deans of the most respected law deans in the state of California. They had one person working as an assistant to Jerry. Bill was passed by the legislature, but there was some substantial private donations which helped pay for these the executive assistants and for people to come to hearings. So what the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice did is that they focused on all the big issues. And they began holding a series of hearings to investigate these issues and to come up with a series of recommendations. So they held hearings on eyewitness identification and how that could be redressed. And they brought in people from all across the country that had all sides of the issues and the experts in the field. And they held hearings. And you can go to their website and you can look at all the hearings. Everything is transparent. And then they issued a set of recommendations, and then they moved on to the next issue, which was an interesting way to proceed. So they looked at interrogations, they looked at crime labs, they looked at jailhouse informants. We had a lot of that in California. Eventually they went to look at the death penalty. And I can actually say that the California system of capital punishment is crazier than any in the country, crazier than here in the state of Texas. They have, you know, over 600 people on death row, and the courts can't even keep up with the cases. I mean, that is, by everybody's estimation in the system, a mess. So they're looking at all those things, and they issued these series of recommendations. A number of their recommendations became legislation that was passed by both houses. Governor Schwarzenegger, for the last 2 years, had vetoed an eyewitness identification bill and an interrogation bill. They did pass a forensic science bill that set up a task force, and when I leave you this afternoon, I'm going to go visit with them in Sacramento tomorrow. So they're working forward on a lot of these things will become law, even if they haven't already, and have also led all kinds of players within the system to make changes. I'll give you a very simple one that was very interesting. The commission did a study of appellate decisions dealing with defense ineffectiveness and prosecutorial misconduct. And what they did when they looked at these decisions is that it turned out in California there was a statute that said that any time there was misconduct by a lawyer which led to a reversal of the conviction, the matter automatically had to be referred to the California State Bar. I'm a member of the California Bar as well as New York, so you know we had an integrated bar in California, so the judges were supposed to refer the cases. So they did a study of 10 years of these decisions and found that no cases had been referred to the State Bar. Because there was, and not only that, they looked at the cases where there were findings of harmless error and concluded, well, there's no difference between this case where exculpatory evidence, for example, was suppressed, where the defense lawyer, did a terrible job, but the courts didn't reverse the conviction because the defendant was obviously guilty. But the same problems on both sides of the aisle in terms of attorney performance, you know, had to be looked at. So they made some recommendations along those lines, an amendment to the judicial canons, which was very interesting. They also brought in prosecutors' offices and the public defender offices to look at their own internal systems for how to track what goes wrong and how you can fix it within an office. And I actually had a long discussion with Johnny Holmes, the former district attorney of Houston, about this matter. Because in the course of our discussion, I sent to him all the cases over his period as district attorney in Houston where there had been reversals for failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, some misconduct like that, or ones where there were harmless error. And when I sent it to them, he was quite surprised because he did not know of most of them. In fact, all except one, and even disagreed with the courts that some of the decisions where they said it was harmless error. Johnny said, "No, I'm not. I can't believe it," and believed that he actually might have made an error in terms of having what he thought was an open file discovery process. But he just thought that he could expect everybody in the office to just do what he did, and in retrospect, thought perhaps that was unwise. And we see that both in defender offices and in prosecutor offices, that some greater attention to internal processes to make sure, for example, the issue would seem to me for Mr. Holmes, and he agreed, was that when a case is reversed by the courts because it's felt that a prosecutor did something wrong or a defense lawyer didn't act effectively, one should go back and take a look at some of the other prior cases to see if it happened before. That is a basic notion of auditing the system that can work everywhere. And in fact, of course, it's now the law, federal law, with respect to crime labs. I'm sure we'll discuss that in the course of these meetings. But you already have here in the state of Texas a very good statute. Your Forensic Science Commission that does that kind of auditing when there's a case of serious misconduct, serious negligence or misconduct. So in any event, California has their commission is sunsetting, in a few months, and they've gone through all the big issues, and I think that everybody is a good collaborative process. I probably should have started this way, is that most of you know me here as the lawyer that comes down and works with our innocence projects in Texas and helps, get people out of prison with post-conviction DNA evidence because that's what we've been doing. But I am a law professor for 30 years. And in fact, I've spent a lot of my time working as a commissioner of forensic science in the state of New York overseeing our crime labs for 16 years. I've served on federal commissions with the Justice Department on implementing DNA data banks and use of DNA and forensic evidence in the United States. I served on that for 6 years. Worked even with Ashcroft when he got in. I was a holdover. I was on his task forces. And the reason that I'm involved in this and my partner, Peter Neufeld, is that what we've realized about our innocence work that makes it interesting and different is that every time an innocent person is convicted, the individual who really committed the crime is at large and can commit more. And no better example than yesterday in the Stephen Phillips case, because here was a man that was convicted of a very unique and unusual kind of sexual assault, where he would walk into places where there were women in gymnasiums, and he had a hood and a German Luger, and he drove an Eldorado, red Eldorado, and the individual would committed these terrible crimes, and Phillips was convicted of one. Although he had two trials, first for rape and then for first for burglary and then for rape, and then pled guilty to nine other offenses so that he didn't spend the rest of his life in jail. And then the Conviction Integrity Unit did this fantastic investigation, and we found out not only did the DNA test show he didn't do it, but there was one individual named Sidney Goodyear who had been committing these crimes in Wichita, Kansas, and Houston, and Los Angeles, all across the country. And there will be some kind of a retrospective examination of that, but I think it's pretty clear to all of us who are involved in the case that a lot of this could have been prevented. Not just the wrongful conviction of Goodyear, Phillips, but Goodyear could have been apprehended earlier. And in out of the 218 exonerations, we don't count Goodyear because we wait till the Court of Appeals confirms them before we put it up on our website. In over 77 of the cases, the real perpetrator has been identified. So that's what makes this work so interesting, and as of course I don't need to tell this group, that only 10% of serious felony cases have any biology in it that we can test. So what about the other 90% of the cases, and what can go wrong there, and how we can improve the system? So what happens, I think, in each of these groups, whether you want to call them innocence commissions or policy groups or study groups, that the recommendations that people come up with are win-win propositions. They're good law enforcement. Because every one of these things, the whole point is to enhance the capability of law enforcement, the court system, to get it right. And so that's been the mission. In Pennsylvania, Senator Stuart Greenleaf, who is a Republican from Montgomery County, and known to be a conservative, is the driving force behind the establishment of a commission on wrongful convictions, which is now taking evidence much in the way that you started to do in the state of Pennsylvania. And again, it's a group that has representation from all across the criminal justice system. They're working on a lot of these problems systematically, all with the hope of coming up with solutions that everybody can accept, and legislation that can help implement it. And that's why it's housed in part at Duquesne Law School with John Rago, who's an assistant dean there, who's the executive director. And that one really just started in 2006. Well, the resolution was passed in 2006. They geared up really to get it going last year. And again, that commission will sunset and expect that it's going to issue a set of recommendations much in the way that the California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice did. I should talk about, we have an innocence commission in the state of Connecticut. I must say it's the first statute passed, but it really hasn't worked out that well at this point in time. I think they're going to take up eyewitness reform, but it was a joint venture between the University of New Haven, which was a police institution that trains a lot of police officers, and Yale Law School. And unfortunately, it amounted to no more than just a seminar. Nothing significant has come out of that, although we're hopeful that with the help of the prosecutors in New Haven and a new state's attorney, that they're going to get some eyewitness efforts, legislation, maybe the use of the computers that I'll show you this afternoon, going in the state of Connecticut. And finally, I should note North Carolina. And because I think North Carolina, out of all these efforts, is the one that's probably closest to what you're doing here in the state of Texas. And that commission started by the then Chief Justice Beverly Lake. And Judge Lake had actually attended a seminar on wrongful convictions that was put together by the National Institute of Justice. We had teams that came from all across the country, not dissimilar to the ones that the court has been running in Plano. And so a number of presentations were made, and Chief Justice Lake just said, well, I'm going to get this done. So he convened this North Carolina commission and, again, brought in people from all sides of the system and said, let's tackle a series of these problems. They started with eyewitness identification because it is actually the single greatest cause of the conviction of the innocent, at least as demonstrated by the DNA testing. There's some other causes that are really high up there, but we all know that's a big one. And he again pulled everybody in the system together, and they began this effort to find out everything they could about best practices for doing eyewitness identification procedures. They got buy-in from just about everybody in the system. And in fact, I'm going to show you this afternoon a PowerPoint presentation of a computerized way of administering eyewitness identification procedure photo arrays that embodies, you know, all the best practices. And that was all developed originally in North Carolina because they set these statutes. They passed a series of regulations on how the eyewitness procedure should be done. And in Charlotte, North Carolina, what I'm going to show you this afternoon takes place, and Winston-Salem and all across the state. And that really is a result of Judge Beverly Lake's commission. And finally, what they did, which was very interesting, and something that I think could be of great use to you here in Texas, is that they were looking for some way to make sure that meritorious cases of actual innocence could be reviewed on a factual basis without flooding the court system. Because in North Carolina, there were a lot of procedural bars for successive writs, and that was a great concern to them. So they set up, actually, a North Carolina Innocence Commission that will hear these cases, much in the way of the Criminal Case Review Commission set up in the United Kingdom, and then we'll make recommendations back to the court if they find a particular case where they can view the conviction as unsafe. And another way of looking at that is they use the innocence projects at the University of North Carolina Law School in Wake Forest and Duke as the labor and oars in that. And so that was a very interesting innovation on how to without flooding the court system with all these cases, having some way to review them that would work. Because these cases happen, they're not the norm, but they happen, we all know, and there's plenty of them where there's no DNA evidence. So that was one solution that they came up with in North Carolina. So I think that actually concludes what's going on across the country. But that's the North Carolina one is the one I ended on because I really think it was the commitment of the court bringing in everybody else in the system, much way that the Court of Criminal Appeals has stepped forward here today in pulling together this commission that really made that work. I should say their eyewitness reform legislation, they're all voluntary regulations on how to do eyewitness procedures, but after the Duke LaCrosse case, it became a statute overnight because obviously they didn't follow those procedures in the Duke LaCrosse case.
Barry, doesn't New Jersey, didn't they pass legislation?
Well, New Jersey is the leader. New Jersey, and that is an interesting situation. Eyewitness reform. That was a man named John Farmer. And John Farmer was a Republican Attorney General in Christine Whitman's administration. He's actually a very great public servant. He was one of the leading reporters for the 9/11 Commission. He's a very interesting man. And he had been involved in a case as a prosecutor where an innocent person had been convicted by mistaken identification. So he tried to investigate this. He brought all the experts in. And the Attorney General in the state of New Jersey has very unique powers. the Attorney General in New Jersey can say, I like this. I think this is the way everybody ought to do it. And then issues an order, and all state and local law enforcement have to follow these rules. So that's how they did it in New Jersey, but that's a jurisdiction.
Is that Attorney General appointed by the governor or elected?
No, it's elected, appointed by the governor, okay, as a matter of fact. And actually, the Attorney General appoints all the other Attorney General local prosecutors in the different counties throughout the state of New Jersey. So it's kind of a unique system. The Attorney General there has a lot of power.
I know Jim Turley's from New Jersey. Of course, I think New Jersey has a distinction of having the strongest gubernatorial form of government in the country. So it's a cabinet form of government. So the governor appoints the Attorney General, and then the Attorney General has that power.
I actually forgot one commission. It's a more than a Freudian slip. New York. I have to tell you that as I started coming here in 2000 to Texas, you know, people can say what they want about Texas, but I thought when I started working with everybody in the Texas legislature that this was Athens, all right, compared to New York. New York, I don't think there's any doubt about it, is one of the most backward systems for getting legislation in the country. It's three guys in a room. It's the governor, the speaker of the assembly, and the head of the Senate. And every year, doesn't matter what happens, all the hearings, everybody gets into a room, and they trade back and forth, they make the budget, they pass all the bills, that's what happens. So there's been a lot of legislation on innocence and criminal justice reform that's come out of both houses in New York. But because of all kinds of trading back and forth and deadlocks, it doesn't get done. I think we're the third highest state, maybe the second, the third probably behind Illinois in terms of exonerations. So the state bar decided finally that they were going to weigh in, and they are formed a commission now that's going to issue reports. They already did one, a pilot studies on videotaping interrogations. But now they're going to go back and look, they're systematically looking back at all the wrongful convictions in the state of New York and studying those, and will issue some recommendations. Now, I can't believe I forgot the most interesting of all, anyway, Illinois. When we found all these people on death row in Illinois, there were 13 exonerations versus 12 executions. As you will recall, the Republican governor in Illinois first declared a moratorium and then eventually gave clemency, life sentences, to 173 people on Illinois' death row. But during that period, he also set up what were known as the Ryan Commission reports. And this was a panel, again, very similar to what you set up here, that again was looking at not just the death penalty, but all other problems that could lead to wrongful convictions, forensic science, eyewitness identification, interrogations, and they issued a series of reports. The chair of it was our friend Tom Sullivan, who was the former United States Attorney in the Northern District of Illinois and the managing partner then of the Jenner and Block law firm. And a series of bills came out eventually based on their recommendations from the Illinois legislature. And there was a little-known state senator that carried all those bills, and his name was Barack Obama. So this is, I hope, going to be part of the presidential dialogue. You've heard Obama talk about, as his example of how he can work on both sides of the system, the bill that he got passed on videotaping interrogations in the state of Illinois. Now, incidentally, I hope McCain, and I think he will, because his criminal justice person, Ted Olson, is a friend of mine, and his ex-wife, who was in the airplane, was my student. So I think they're very interested in these things as well. But I only note that because that really was a result of these Illinois commissions. So I think a lot of these ideas that you'll be discussing here in all these fields, the forensic science issues, I know are going to be coming to the fore when the National Academy of Sciences issues a report on forensic science in December or January, and you're already well situated to take advantage of that. Many of these issues that you'll be discussing, I think it will be part of the national agenda in the next 4 years, no matter who's elected president of the United States.
Thank you, Barry. I just want you all to know, if you've never worked with Barry, and his organization in New York, they're wonderful people. They have gobs and gobs and gobs of information, and they'll give you whatever they've got, and they'll help you in any way, and so I appreciate all their efforts. And I do have to acknowledge my briefing intern, because she did all the hard work of pulling this together, Mrs. Rose, and she's worked very hard, and she's talked to most of you, and we owe her a lot of thanks, so Rose, thank you. Now I wanted to tell you about the biggest challenge we have is we've got so many ideas, and we really have to focus on the important ones, because if we need legislation, we're getting close to session. So the educational component, the court can work with that, but we really have to start getting serious about focusing on what legislative reforms we need. I want to share with you, I worked with Senator Ellis on some of the issues that we're concerned about. We talked about education. We're looking at DNA or lab reliability in general, eyewitness identification and videotape confessions, the collection, preservation, and storage of evidence, innocence clinics, writ process, public defenders, and indigent representation and exoneree compensation. Now, we were working very hard on pulling all of this together for this meeting, and the court just got out of session at the end of June. But we've already accomplished some things, and I'm real proud to share that with you. For example, Judge Harrell, who is our criminal district judge member here, was given an assignment to contact all the criminal district judges in the state to find out what they're doing with the evidence after the trial's over. He said you could tell them about your surprising results so far.
I was given homework by Judge Hurry, so I sent an email to all of the state district judges, and astoundingly got a pretty good response. Had every jurisdiction respond in some way, shape, or form. Found that everybody is complying pretty much, with the exception of one jurisdiction, with Article 2.21 of the Code of Criminal Procedure and 34.6G of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, which basically leave it up to the court reporter while the appeal is being perfected to hold the exhibits and evidence. And then it goes, depending on the size of the jurisdiction, to the district clerk, and contraband, drugs, weapons go either to the sheriff or back to the investigating agencies that submitted them. What I found somewhat unusual was all of the biological evidence, which is what we are concerned about preserving and maintaining, is just dumped on the district clerk, with the exception of one jurisdiction that segregates it and keeps it separate and apart from the other exhibits, and one jurisdiction, El Paso, which segregates it and keeps it refrigerated during the course and for post-conviction remedies, etc. So we were most interested in the biological exhibits, and I got an email from one of the district judges saying we need to concentrate on biological evidence that was not admitted and track that and keep that to where it can be utilized for post-conviction remedies and writs. But we got a pretty good response, and they're thinking about it. The judges are all looking for adopting a best practice and a methodology, so I think this commission could be instrumental in making some recommendations in that regard. But I was amazed that very little is being done with the biological evidence at this point.
And I was very pleased with that. It might seem like a small thing, but we can't even talk about how to correct the collection, preservation, and storage if we don't know what everybody's doing. So Sid's efforts, I think, were great and made some big progress. Another area, I have this pet project. They've all heard it. They're sick of listening to it. My court's heard it ad nauseum. But I want to create another reliability factor for the labs. And so excuse my simpleton explanation of how this would work. But I want to create a traveling DNA lab. It actually would be a traveling lab and a stationary lab. And they would travel around and work kind of like health departments when they go into restaurants and knock on the door and say, ha, surprise, we're here, and we're going to check you out. So when ASCLAD comes, labs know they're coming, the coats are clean, the floors are clean, and what have you. And these people would be able to go in, and Michael Bromwich, who is the gentleman that led the attack on the FBI crime lab and the Houston crime lab, is willing to help us set up the protocol DPS has been wonderful. They encourage us to do this because, as Pat has told me, if they get a check mark, then they've got another good mark that shows they're doing good work. And if they don't, then they've got things that they know they need to fix. The DPS, which does the lion's share of our testing, is working with us on this. They've already given me a list of the equipment that we need. I don't think it would cost that much money. And I've talked to Senator Ellis and Senator Whitmire both about this. I have a lot of people willing to take the bill in, and we already have a forensic science commission. So I think we have a logical place to house the results. So we wouldn't have to establish another bureaucratic agency to do that. So that's my little pet project. And according to Michael Bromwich, nobody in the country is doing this. So that's something I would like to see. As far as the incense clinics are concerned, I made a little speech in front of the legislature two sessions ago about the clinics, the need for the clinics. I'm going to make another one. I don't know how far I'll get. Senator Ellis and Senator Duncan both supported our efforts to have clinics established in all 9 law schools in this state. I know that there's been some concern about giving public money to private universities, but I went to St. Mary's. And St. Mary's is in a great position because half the student body speaks fluent Spanish. And that can be very helpful with dealing with Spanish-speaking inmates. So I would like to see all 9. Now, not all 9, our last count, not all 9 wanted to participate. But those that do should be allowed to do that. I think the clinics need some additional help. Jeff Blackburn has been very good. He's given me a list of some things that they would like to have, a wish list, and we're going to work with Sharon's task force and see what we can accomplish and ask for through the legislature. Then with the writ process, I told you that Sion and another member of our writ staff have been very helpful in trying to get the ball rolling on educating judges on how to do writs. We have probably 50% of our writs every week when we go to conference remanded to the trial courts for various reasons. Sometimes they just don't get it. Sometimes we need additional information for various reasons. It's not the trial court's fault that they don't understand how to do these things. They've never been trained. We didn't go to writ school. So they want to learn, but there's nothing out there to educate them. So we're going to have some education for them. Sion has just worked on a portion of the capital bench book through the Texas Center for the Judiciary to educate judges on how to handle capital writs. That's not the bulk of our writs, 6,000 to 8,000 regular post-conviction writs. I want to create a Dick, Jane, and Sally book like they create for little kids to learn about the court system for judges to be able to handle writs. They need to know and they want to know, so we need to educate them. Fence bar and prosecutors also need some writ training so that everybody's on the same page as to how to handle these. I'd like to see a specialized Dick, Jane, and Sally book on how to handle innocence writs because they really scare trial judges. I have no idea what I'm supposed to do here. And again, it's not their fault, but we can educate them on that. So that's something we want to work on. Public defenders. As you know, the governor has made some public statements that he would like to create more public defender's offices. That's fine, but I do believe that if for years everyone was complaining about the poor quality of criminal representation, which I disagree with, my husband's a criminal defense attorney, so I think there are some very fine criminal defense attorneys, but just like the scrutiny that we put on the criminal defense bar, the regular criminal defense bar, we have to have some standards, some performance standards, not how many cases they're winning, but actual performance standards by which to measure their work. And my friend, who's the head of the appellate public defender's office in Bexar County, has developed their own standards. I have them. I haven't had a chance to look at them, but Angela's willing to do it, and we'll get some other public defenders to assist. And we'll work with those and have some standards in creating that. So these are some of the ideas that I've got myself. I'm sure that all these fine members of this committee will have other ideas, and they'll help me with the ones I've got. So I just wanted to share with you some of my concepts.
Tisha, on the issue of preservation of evidence, Craig did mention it, and Frank can comment on it, but one reason why have been so many exonerations out of Dallas County is because they preserve evidence. Right. And it calls to question whether or not there should be some state standard. That may be technology or some invention 5 years, 5 months from now that will permit us to discover more culprits and also determine whether or not more people who are in jail are the people who should be there. But if you don't have evidence, you don't have it. I mean, but regardless of, I've heard the various scenarios on why that evidence was preserved in Dallas County, whether it was Kennedy assassination or whatever. And then access to it, because in some counties, in my county, as the issue of whether or not it's preserved, even if it is there, sometimes it takes an act of God to get it. The DNA statute that we operate under, my office drafted, with Barry Shett, in fact, it's how I met Barry. I always point out sometimes, as his board chair, they don't necessarily like it, but that I'm for death penalty. You know, one of the few people in the Senate who's had to say on 3 occasions the state will proceed. Most people remember me for the one time I said state wouldn't proceed. And it led to that DNA statute on the Ricky McGinn case. But, you know, it makes me wonder, in that statute, with the exoneration that you had before our meeting on the 74, Taylor, I think was his name, you know, whether or not we should have so many hoops there that the defense has to go through, whether there ought to be some other mechanism to go in and in certain limited cases be able to go in and do the testimony. I think you mentioned 200 or 400 cases.
400.
When it was denied, you went through it. I mean, I don't remember all the details of the deal. I had Hannah Lieberman Dershowitz on my staff who sort of did the work, and then that I had the luck of becoming finance chair. So I gave that bill, which was negotiated, instead of to Duncan. And he pretty much left it the way it was. But should we revisit that section? When Barry went to various states, what he did mention, and I just be curious to know, was funding or resources. Whether it's a foundation or whatever in California, I guess it was a Senate resolution, I assume because they couldn't get a bill passed. And they probably had a House resolution, but like, how was it funded? This hookup with law schools, like when all these ideas come in, if we have 4 months, 8, 9, 10, maybe 4 months before we go in session, if there are things we can agree on, then maybe we could go to the governor and try to get passed. You went to the issue of, mandatory sentencing is what you're making reference to. And Chairman Madden had a bill that we had in the Senate, got out of Senate and got to the House. If it were not for the meltdown in the House, that bill may have passed, essentially making every court a drug court. Say that it was a low-level, nonviolent drug user, small amount, sentence them to rehab. But on some of these things we agree on, the governor has said privately a dollar amount. The week before we had our meeting on the Senate floor in terms of money for public defender offices, for indigent defense. His task force, which you and I were on, recommended a bill to create public defender offices for capital cases, right? Now, that'd be a lot to get the emergency tag. I mean, it's not enough to just be for it and then say, well, the clock ran out. Well, the clock runs out every time. But somebody, I'm just suggesting we think process-wise, in terms of resources, to get some of the things we can agree on before the legislature goes in, and when it has the stature of this court, some judges on this court, district attorneys, I think it helps us to move the ball forward in Texas so we don't end up being like whatever state that was, that it was more talk.
New York.
You mentioned another state.
I think it's Connecticut.
Where it was just a dialogue. To do something. So I just want to, Barry, did I, if I might, was there anything on this issue of funding?
It was actually a bill that passed both houses in the California legislature, but it didn't have any money. So I think there was $1 million that was put forward by foundations. I think it was actually the Open Society Institute and the Jet Foundation that financed the California Commission.
Because it's like with Blackboard, even with the $100,000 the state gives, Mayor, I've just forgotten. I do so much. What is our budget? Is it three or five? Five of me. And I guess we had, it was through a private law school, by the way, where we started. So I'm not into the issue of public versus private. It is a private law school that we are affiliated with that helps us, not as much as they did at one point. We appreciate all we can get and have opted to stay there. And now that Barry and Peter got the statute, got in Columbia and other schools wanted the Innocence Project, but we opted to stay with Cardozo. But what's your budget like?
You have $100,000.
Total. I mean, your total budget.
All the other, there are four projects that get that. In this state, a couple of projects from UT are here. And I think we submitted some papers, and I don't know if that made it into y'all's package or not, but we'll describe our budgets and what our needs are. But, you know, the problem, I mean, that's obviously a joke. That's nowhere near enough money. All of us, none of us are able to do anything close to what we ought to be doing. All of us are getting swamped with letters. There's a lot of work to do.